R&D with a budget. Secondly, let's be frank. Many of the issues you raise are technically very complex for the average politician. So our research team does a lot of the background work, and we try to understand what you say. And then we get briefed by them. And if we want to engage with you, never mind that there aren't enough MPs here, we've got a very competent team in Sakhela, Slope, and others. And so we literally, between the MPs and the research team, read everything you say. So I'm pleading with you to stick with your time. Secondly, also, it's very, let's say, it's something I don't relish. I don't think most cheers with. Well, I can't speak for others, that I have to tell you, please, your time is up. Then 2 minutes later, please, your time is up. It's really, firstly, it's very stressful, quite frankly. It's a power that I get no satisfaction from. You may not believe this of a politician. And you mostly are very technically sophisticated people. For what it's worth, if you're an academic or a politician, you can go to an international conference. It is very rare you're given more than 10 minutes. Very rare. So I know the cost to you is enormous. The issues are quite big. The consequences for you could be major. But you know what? The more important thing is we process your representations to us in written form properly. And I personally feel that, you know, you should come here and just speak for 3 minutes to what you've written. We should ideally read it beforehand. We should read it beforehand. We should engage with the researchers where we don't understand. Get technical expertise from outside, independent of all the professional associations here. And then we'll meet with you and say, right, 3 minutes please, then we exchange it. That's the way I would like it to be. But in the real world, that's not possible. Fine, over to PwC, it's 9:30. So it's 10 minutes, really. Obviously, it's here some latitude. If you make some startling input that's completely unexpected, or you may break into tears if I say, please, your time is up, I'll allow some latitude. But please, can we stick with 10, maximum 12? I know it's an odd amount of minutes, but that's how we managed it, based on the number of submissions we received. So I'm going by the iPhone. You can switch your own iPhone on, or Samsung, whatever you have, to guide you. Right, let's start. Thank you, PwC. Well, we know you, but you can introduce yourself quickly for others who may not.
Thank you, Chair. Just a matter of clarification, are we just going to work with hard copies today, or are we working with electronic?
In what sense? We've got all the hard copies. Here they are. And then they'll be on the screen if you've asked for them to be put on. Have you asked for them to be put on?
Yeah, they were sent to...
IT system. We've only had 23 years. Expecting too much.
Not a problem. We'll work with the hard copies.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Okay, let's go. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. For those who don't know, my name is Kyle Mandy. I'm the tax policy leader at PwC. I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to present to you this morning, short as it may be. We've obviously made a detailed written submission and so on, and I would encourage you to go through that. It is comprehensive and addresses a number of areas that I'm not even going to touch on today. So today I'm simply going to touch on four areas that I want to highlight. So please bear with me as I go through that. The first one is in relation to the repeal of the Foreign Employment Tax Exemption. Now, this matter you're going to hear a lot about on today has become quite an emotive issue, and understandably so, given what is proposed. So by way of background, just to remind you what that relates to, it is the Employment Tax Exemption, exemption for foreign employment services if you're out of the country for more than 183 days. It was introduced in 2001 with the introduction of residence-based taxation, and Treasury is proposing to now repeal that around concerns around double mod taxation. In the budget, it was announced that the exemption would only be repealed in relation to where the salaries in question were not subject to tax in the other state. The proposal in the bill goes further than that now, though. It actually proposes the wholesale repeal of the exemption while giving a credit for the foreign taxes paid. What are the concerns in relation to that? As I've already mentioned, it's going to be a highly emotive issue, and the key is to actually cut through that emotion and look at the hard facts. And the hard facts are that it's actually going to give rise to a significant increase in compliance burden for taxpayers and also an increase in administrative burden for SARS. It is also going to have a number of unintended consequences, including significant and harsh, in certain circumstances, financial implications for expats. It will potentially lead to an increase in immigration. And bearing in mind that in many of these expats, in any event, may inadvertently have already migrated their tax residences to other countries, potential for capital flight as a result of such financial immigration, and perhaps even more importantly, it's going to potentially have a significant impact on the competitiveness of South African businesses insofar as foreign projects are concerned. It will also potentially result in double taxation in certain instances, particularly given that no credit for foreign social security contributions is available in South Africa. And it will it doesn't also take into account the significantly higher cost of living in almost all countries in which South African resident individuals seek employment. So what are we recommending in relation to this? Well, we do understand the concern of National Treasury insofar as this exemption is concerned, but we believe that the wholesale repeal of the exemption should be reconsidered and a full review done of the potential economic impacts of this. And also, if we're going to go ahead with something, we need to take into account other options as well as take into account mechanisms to mitigate both the compliance burdens and the unintended consequences as well. In the slide pack, if you go to slide number 5, there's a whole analysis that we've done there, which is just an attempt to, if you like, illustrate the potential implications and how wide-ranging those implications are going to be insofar as the tax impact is concerned. I don't want to go through that in detail. I'll let you work through it in your own time. But the important point to note is that you'll see that in almost all instances, the South African tax that will be payable actually exceeds the foreign taxes that are paid in the example that we've utilised. And that notwithstanding that many of the tax rates in those countries are relatively high tax rates, in some instances as high as South Africa or even higher in the case of a country like Zimbabwe. The next point that I wanted to address is in relation to the tax relief proposed for bargaining councils. Now, what Treasury is proposing here is to essentially grant an amnesty in exchange for a small levy for bargaining councils who have been non-compliant with regards to employees' tax and income tax. On the basis that if these councils were to be subjected to penalties and interest, they would be placed under severe financial distress. Now, the relief that is proposed is, as I said, effectively an amnesty in exchange for a very small levy of 10% of the taxes that would otherwise have to be paid. We have some major concerns with the messaging insofar as this is concerned. And the question that we have to pose is, why is a certain type of taxpayer being singled out for special treatment? The relief that is being offered up to the bargaining councils is extraordinarily generous, goes way beyond the reliefs that we've seen under VDP or even the special VDP or any of the previous amnesties for that matter, and even goes insofar as offering relief in relation to taxpayers where the tax returns are not even due as we sit. So it does raise serious questions around equity and fairness. And the question that we have to ask and answer, in a sense, is what would the impact of this be on tax morality for other compliant taxpayers? So we have some serious concerns around that proposal. The second last issue I want to deal with is around the share buybacks and dividend stripping proposals. Now, as a reminder, what this relates to, it's a concern around essentially proceeds from disposable shares being turned into tax-exempt dividends in the form of either dividend stripping or the proceeds being in respect of a share buyback and essentially taking the form of a dividend and therefore exempt from tax. Now, we are not opposed to the proposal at all. In fact, we're actually supportive of it in principle. We do, however, have a couple of concerns in that regard, which are set out on slide number, bear with me. One of the proposals or mechanisms to address this, and bear in mind that essentially what Treasury is proposing is that those dividends would be added to the proceeds on disposal of the shares and treated as taxable rather than as exempt, is that any dividends that are received within 18 months prior to the disposal will also be treated as proceeds on disposal of the shares and taxable as such. Now, our concern with that is it catches normal dividends. It doesn't only catch, if you like, what I'd call extraordinary dividends. And bearing in mind that the concern from a policy point of view here, or the mischief that we're dealing with, is around the stripping of value out of the share in the form of abnormal dividends. So we should not be concerned with ranked normal dividends here. Because those will now also be caught by this proposal, such that those dividends, any normal dividends within 18 months prior to the disposal, will also be added to proceeds. So our recommendation is that this provision should deal only with extraordinary dividends. There is precedent for this already in the tax legislation, particularly so far as CGT is concerned, dealing with losses arising from dividend stripping, where it only applies in the case of extraordinary dividends as defined there. So our recommendation is that this should have a similar, if not identical, provision dealing with that. The other concern is that it also deals with dividends that are paid prior to the 19th of July. Now, while that might be effectively retrospective in effect, and we acknowledge that Treasury is well within the law. While we acknowledge that the Treasury certainly has the right to go and include those dividends should they so desire, the question is whether it is the correct thing to do. So our suggestion is that this provision should only apply to dividends that are received on or after the 19th of July, which is the effective date of the provision, should not apply in the case of dividends received prior to 19th of July. The final concern that we have in relation to this provision is that it doesn't draw a distinction between what we would refer to as equity shares and non-equity shares. Now, equity shares are essentially your normal ordinary shares that participate in profits, whereas your non-equity shares would be such things as preference shares, which don't participate in profits per se, they're not equity. They are no more than, or they carry no rights other than a right to generally a fixed yield in relation to dividends on those shares. Now, those shares, being non-equity shares, don't represent a concern from a policy point of view, and in our view should be excluded from the ambit of this anti-avoidance provision. The final issue that I want to address is in relation to the proposals for CFCs to deal with foreign trusts and foundations. And I'm not this is a highly technical provision. I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritty detail of it, but in essence, what Treasury are proposing to do is now include within the ambit of CFCs those foreign companies that are held through foreign trusts. Now, again, in principle, we are supportive of what Treasury is trying to do here to bring this within the CFC net. The difficulty that we have is that the manner in which the legislation has been drafted gives rise to a number of broad concerns. Number one, it far from creating certainty, it actually gives rise to further uncertainties and all the implications that are entailed with that. And so the provisions are, in our view, don't achieve what they're attempting to achieve, and are overly complex in some senses, and uncertain in terms of the application. So that needs to be sorted out. The other issue that we have in relation to this proposal is that actually, and partly because of the uncertainty, it actually hasn't completely closed down the loophole, if you like. So it does leave potential loopholes, gaps, still open. So if you're going to, if you want to shut this thing down, then you need to shut it down properly and so on. And of course, we'd be more than happy to engage with Treasury to help them achieve what they're trying to achieve here. The final concern that we have in relation to this proposal is actually that these potentially use double tax on a number of different fronts, and I'm not going to get into the technical detail of that. We'll obviously engage with Treasury further insofar as that's concerned. But those are the four main issues that I wanted to address. As I mentioned earlier, obviously there are other concerns that we have with the law. We will be engaging with Treasury further in relation to those, and I'll repeat again, and I encourage you to read our written comprehensive submission as well. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kyle. We'll go through the next three presentations, then we'll have a discussion. So questions, please hold them, members. And over to SAIT. Keith, are you going to do?
Yes, thank you. Keith Engel from the South African Institute of Tax Professionals. I think you know me as a bit of a troublemaker, so that's something else. We won't put that on my resume. Eric is with me. We're going to share this. We're going to try to keep in our time, so go.
Excellent. On the foreign remuneration exemption, the only thing that I'd like to add to what Carl has said is that we've engaged very widely with multinationals and their advisors, and the consistent complaint is that the system whereby SARS gives you a foreign tax credit for the foreign taxes that you've paid offshore against your South African tax is simply not working. They say even if you do everything correct, if you give all the information, all the documentation in the right format, you will struggle 2 years to get your foreign tax credit back. And in the meantime, you would have paid, say, 30% tax in Nigeria and 45% tax in South Africa if this proposal goes ahead. So you would have paid 75% tax while you're waiting for your 30% Nigerian tax to come back to you. So we very strongly say that this system of foreign tax credits, if this proposal were to go ahead, must be fixed first. And it's really, really not working. They say different officials deal with things differently, etc. Okay, then going on to the share buyback that Kyle discussed in detail, I'll just say we're fully supportive of what Kyle has said. So we support that the loophole is closed, and we just think that ordinary dividends should not be caught both on and also not on non-equity shares. So over to Keith.
Yeah. I think the big issue for us at SAIT here is the issue of business rescue. Now, we all know we're in difficult economic times right now, and we need to be careful. There are a lot of companies that are in the middle of trying to get rid of the debt. They're trying to restructure. And what you see in the briefing, and it's a little odd, when I've looked at the briefing a few times, it's talking about relief for business rescue with one little anti-avoidance amendment. When I look at the explanatory memorandum, frankly, I'm a bit confused. But when I look at the law is overwhelmingly anti-avoidance for people who are trying to do debt relief restructuring. And this, maybe I'm misreading it, I'm willing to be corrected by my Treasury and my SARS counterparts, but what I'm seeing here is a major narrowing of debt relief and making it a lot more difficult. And I don't think that's the wise thing to do right now. But again, maybe there's an interpretation issue here. But let me just go back what debt relief is about. When you're in trouble economically and you owe a lot of money to somebody else, in theory, the creditor can be very kind and forgive you the debt. Now, if they forgive you the debt, that's a wonderful thing, but you become enriched. So in theory, tax laws say you have taxable income or taxable gain. So here you are, you owe, say, 20 million rand, your creditors forgive you 20 million of debt, and now SARS says, well, you've got to pay a tax bill because you have 20 of gain or 20 of ordinary revenue. Now, that's a theoretically right answer, but our law, Section 19 and 12A, they provide some relief to mitigate that. But those reliefs are kind of haphazard, to be quite honest with you. So what happens is when you have a business restructuring, two very important tools for that debt relief is one, converting the debt to shares, I'll come back to that, and two is group relief. And those are very important forms of relief to get you out of trouble. And right now, businesses need help to get out of trouble. So the main amendments that I'm seeing, it wasn't really discussed, at least from what I can see, but again, I wasn't here, was that the main changes are narrowing those forms of relief. Now, the first form of relief is here you are a bank. Now, banks, as nice as they are, when they lend you money, they want their money back. And they will do everything they can to get that money back. But at some point, you're in such trouble, they start being kind to you. They'll extend the terms. They'll change the interest. They'll do a number of things for you. But when it gets really bad in business rescue, there's a comes point where you're headed to insolvency. And when you're in insolvency, the only remedy for a bank or any other creditor is to say, look, we're going to take over a portion or all of this business, we're going to cancel the debts, and we're going to take the shares of the company, and we're going to hope to resurrect it. And then when we resurrect it, we're going to sell it off. Now, what these amendments appear to do is if you convert that debt into shares and try to resurrect the company, there's a series of anti-avoidance amendments that are trying to trigger gain or income. So the moment the bank is kind enough to forgive you, now all of a sudden SARS is saying they want their share because they're afraid of avoidance. Now, they did appoint a narrow avoidance technique here, but the legislation goes way beyond. The common law has always allowed you to get out of debt by handing over the shares of the company. So if you have debt of, say, $100 million, and you get shares worth $100 million, that shouldn't be taxed. Now, when I read this legislation, again, maybe I'm misreading it, it looks like they're saying, the moment you get yourself out of trouble, we're going to put you back in. And this is not the time. The company doesn't have the cash. It's barely getting through. So these amendments, unless I've misunderstood them, they need to be reconsidered here. Now, there is an avoidance that's bothering SARS very much. And the issue that's bothering them is about value mismatches. Now, to be fair, SARS has been watching these rulings and interpretation notes for quite some time, and they've seen a number of these gone through, and SARS has approved them. But they've spotted a narrow anti-avoidance, which they have mentioned, and what they're coming at is a sledgehammer. But the basic mismatch is, if debt is 100 is owed to you, and the bank only gets shares worth of 80, there's a value mismatch. And that 20 gain is what they're concerned about. And that's fine. If they want to get that gain, that's fine. They have something, they have a code section, we can mention it, where you can fix it, but you don't have to eviscerate the whole ability for debt to be converted into shares. It is very important to allow creditors to rescue the company. This is essentially what business rescue is all about. So I'm mentioning this so much because I'm afraid that our other colleagues are not. This is something we have to consider. The second thing is group relief. Now, when you look again at the briefings and you look at the explanatory memorandum, they're telling you that we're helping business rescue by this new dormant company thing, which I'll have Eric explain. But what they're really doing is eliminating intra-group relief. Now, what you have in large companies, when they're going through difficult times, as they have through the last number of years, they rationalize, they structure, and they clean. One of the things while they're cleaning and rationalizing is they eliminate lots of debt between group members. So group members, you know, parent owes money to sub owes money to parent, sub one owes to sub two. There's all this kind of internal debt. And what they want to do is streamline all that and clean things up. The proposed amendments, it's not stated in the briefing, but from what I can see, they're eliminating that form of relief. And what they're saying is, if you clean up that kind of debt, it's going to give rise to the same gain, same ordinary treatment as any other kind of debt. And I would strongly recommend against that. If there's a problem with an avoidance, which I believe is very narrow, and the mismatch of values, you can handle that there. But really, let's be very careful about letting companies restructure. And I think that's it. Okay.
Excellent. So this new dormant company relief that Keith was referring to, it's just worded incredibly narrow. So it is in a dormant group situation, but the company would have had to be dormant for more than 3 years and have done absolutely nothing. Earned no income, well, not traded, earned no income, incurred no expenses, etc. And that's just unrealistic in the sense that each company has to comply with regulatory requirements like SIPC registration each year, financial statements, tax returns, etc. So it's just very, very onerous, and it really doesn't help you to shut down your dormants and get them out of your life. A different Yes, another related topic is where you have this debt for share exchange across border, the interest that you have claimed on your debt for the last 5 years is recouped if it wasn't taxed in the hands of the lender. So if your holding company is sitting in Luxembourg and they're not subject to tax at all in Luxembourg on that interest, in the past you would still, as a South African company, get the interest deduction. Now, if you elect to do a debt equity swap, in other words, exactly what Keith explained, your holding company subscribes for more shares, they inject the cash into your company and you repay the loan to them, you get rid of that debt, you don't have to pay interest going forward, but now you also, so you don't get an interest deduction going forward in the subsidiary South African company, now you also have to recoup 5 years worth of interest. And essentially what is happening here is Treasury is saying, we don't believe that that funding instrument was a loan for the last 5 years. We're saying it was equity all along, which simply doesn't work. I mean, in practice, we know if the economies go up and down, you might well have a debt that later on becomes not repayable. And most guys have a good intention, and we don't think everybody should be caught this way. There are already three mechanisms, or this is now the third mechanism to monitor that interest deduction. It's thin capitalization, it's the EBITDA rule, and now there's this third rule being added, and we don't see any international precedent for actually having those three rules, especially this last one that's now being suggested.
We're back on debt again. As I said, the legislation talks about debt a lot more than the briefing does. But I think the point that Erica raises is, when you come to an intergroup context, a lot of this debt is real. If you have a 70% control of a company and you have an active minority, that active minority makes that debt real. And many of these amendments assume the transactions are not real. And these things are real. Now, we're about to close in 1 minute. I see I've got about a second or two to go. Let me just raise one thing about banks. While we're also going after business rescue, we're also making it difficult on banks to impair their debt. Now, banks are facing more impairments than ever. And now what we're basically saying is, we're not going to follow what we do for SARB. We're not going to follow what we're going to do for IFRS. We're going to say that we have to have a harsher rule for tax. Now, if the rules for impairment work for SARB, they work for your shareholders, they really need to work for your creditors. You really don't want to have debt rules. You don't want to make it difficult for banks to impair their debt. You want the banks to open up and be kind. We can't be beating at the banks the moment they're kind. So I'll let the Banking Council talk about those issues. But really, we need to be careful with our banks in a time where the only credit we're getting is our local banks. And I will shut it down at that.
Sir, I don't mean any disrespect to PwC. You're addressing the committee. And in fact, Alf Lees is far more technically competent than I am. I'm a sociologist. He's a tax expert. And anyway, the research is here, so yes. Thank you very much. The next person is Saika. Chartered Accountants, right? Where are you? Ah, there you are. And we also have the Parliamentary Budget Office team. There's Dumisani Yanchis, who's the expert on tax, and there's Gloria Mguni there. They're also tax experts.
Thank you much, Chair. My name is Peter Farber. I'm the Senior Executive of Tax at SAICA, and with me today is David Warnocker, who's a member of my National Tax Committee. Chair, we'll, given the limitation on the time available, we'll try and just cover some of them in principle, so we'll try and glance through some of the matters. I think the first matter is just on the consultation. Once again, sounding like a broken record again. But once again, just to note, I think what we're trying to achieve when we raise this point is, how do we get to a best place where we assist both Standing Committee and National Treasury, and that we get the sequence right. In March, when we had this discussion, we would have had some further meetings on this, on both the retrospective and retroactive aspects, as well as consultation, which unfortunately has not happened yet, but we do look forward in having that discussion at some time, so that we stop raising the slide like land tax again and again. So even though you might not want to talk to us that much, but I know you do, we're happy to engage, and we look forward to the the workshops that National Treasury have scheduled in the first week in September to engage with them on quite a multitude of these matters. On the foreign employment exemption, there's already much been said, but I think in principle, most of the submissions in our mind we'd like to conclude is that if we are to say that there must be parity and equity, then that's exactly what should be achieved. So if we are saying that those who are foreign-based in employment are to pay the same taxes, well, then they should be getting the same taxes and getting the same deductions. So they should be in the same position in principle as whether they had worked in South Africa or not. And I think when we look at all these submissions in the administration, etc., that's exactly. So whether you're in a position that you're actually out of pocket from an assessment point of view, or whether you're just out of pocket on a cash flow point of view, I think that's all that we intend, is that National Treasury and concern then look at all the processes, etc., and as a holistically then get the foreign employees in the same position as the South Africans. Is that what we are aiming to achieve in addressing both double non-taxation as well? The matter of the bargaining council has already been raised, and I think once again we'll just talk to the principal. Here we are looking at relief for two parties, namely the bargaining councils themselves and the underlying employees. And I think to us, even though there's some concern on the bargaining council extent of the relief, I think ours is more regarding the very specific nature of relief to very specific employees to a large extent for annual payments, which is not general in nature. And we've got quite concerned that if we do go down this path where we are essentially giving very specific employees exemption from PAYGU, and where there's currently actually frameworks to actually do this, this does set a very dangerous precedent going forward as to which other specific employees then do we decide to give this type of nature of relief rather than addressing specific aspects of transactions like a VDP, etc., where it's not arbitrary or we aren't specifically listing specific people. So once again, we'll not deal to a large extent. I think we'll focus much more of our presentation on the corporate tax matters. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Warnecker. I'm a BDO, and I'm also a member of the National Tax Committee at SAIC. And I'm going to address you on some of the corporate tax issues that we have with the bill, starting with this issue of share buybacks, which already has been touched on. And we've got just two examples which illustrate what the perceived problem is from National Treasury's perspective. But the basic issue is that one can, using different mechanisms, instead of having proceeds accrue on the disposal of shares, which would lead to capital gains tax being collected, rather do it in such a way that dividends which are tax exempt accrue rather than proceeds for CGT. And so the first two slides address that. I'm not going to dwell on that, but the proposal then is to extend the current rules that we have, anti-avoidance rules in our Act, to address these concerns. And in particular, there's a timing rule of 18 months, and within 18 months, if dividends then accrued on shares without any causal link to the sale, these dividends become recharacterized as for capital gains tax purposes or gross income purposes. And we've got a problem with this issue that there's no causal link between the dividend and the sale. Then there's a reduction in the ownership requirement from 50% to 20% if no shareholder holds the majority of the shares. There's some issues around that as well in the way it's been introduced into the bill. There's no connection to loan or other funding from the purchaser as presently required. I think that was intended. And then the provision would apply retrospectively to the 19th of July 2017, and we believe, in line with also PwC mentioned, that it should apply to dividends that are declared on or after that date rather than disposals on or after that date, because it could actually be retroactive in catching transactions that were entered into before that date with certain suspensive conditions that are only fulfilled thereafter, so it could actually be retroactive. So we believe, as I mentioned, there should be a causal link between the dividend and the sale. The time-based rule, as I mentioned, should apply to dividends declared on or after the 19th of July. And then there's an issue with regard to the qualifying interest, which I'm not going to go into, but basically we believe that that's too wide in it, the way it's been proposed, and that little example illustrates it. Then we also note that the proposed anti-avoidance provision should only apply to the holding of equity shares, and the way it's been worded is that if one holds equity shares and preference shares, dividends on the preference shares would also be caught, which is surely not what was intended. So in other words, dividends that accrue on preference shares, which are commonly used in financing structures for BEE purposes, for example, prior to redemption of the preference shares would also be recharacterized as proceeds or gross income, depending on the holding of those shares. The second issue that we want to raise is this question of the CFC extension of those rules to trusts. The basic idea behind controlled foreign company legislation is basically that in the absence of that, South African residents could set up companies in tax havens and transact through those companies and avoid South African tax. So it's an important measure. It's common cause that where an actual business is conducted in a foreign jurisdiction that there shouldn't be any attribution of CFC income. It's perceived that non-resident trusts that hold interest in controlled foreign companies are not presently caught. So in other words, if a South African company has got an interest in a foreign trust which holds foreign shares, that's not presently caught, and that's what the legislation seeks to address as one of its arms of it. We doubt whether that is in fact, whether the legislation, the way it's been worded, is actually going to achieve anything. So what we're looking at is where a South African company has got an interest in a foreign trust, and that there then is no direct link between the South African company and the foreign company. So that the proposal as it's presently drafted is that the definition of controlled foreign company will be extended. So it says that where a company has an interest in a foreign trust or a foreign foundation, which in turn holds the interest in the foreign company, that's one of the possibilities, or any foreign company that has to be consolidated in terms of the accounting standard IFRS 10 into a South African parent. So with the first, and then there's a second arm to that, which taxes interest held in foreign trusts by non-companies that are South African residents, where basically any income that is received or accrued from the foreign trust will going forward be taxed as income. So as I mentioned, we don't believe that the proposal, the first leg of that, achieves anything, because if you take a vesting trust, we believe that the current law, currently worded, is sufficient because it deals with indirect interests as well as direct interests. It's currently catered for, no need for any change. On the other hand, discretionary trusts, one wouldn't say that you held an interest in a discretionary trust if you were merely a beneficiary, because all you've really got is a space, or in other words, just a hope of receiving something. It's totally at the discretion of the trustees. So it's not going to address...
You're at 10 minutes, if you can round up the next 2 minutes.
Okay, fine. Yeah, as I was saying, there are a number of issues with that. With regard to Section 25BC, the proposed section which will tax a South African residents on any income received or accrued from a foreign trust, there are major issues with that. Any type of income, whether it's exempt, capital gain in the foreign trust will be taxed as ordinary income, and there's also a double tax issue with regard to a whole multiplicity of provisions that could all apply. Then just very lastly, I think what's already been touched on, the dormant group company debt waiver provisions, a lot of it's already been covered. Our main request is that the current provision that gives intra-group relief for debt waivers should continue and should in fact be duplicated in Section 19. So the current group, if a group two companies owe debt between each other and it's not for purposes of tax avoidance, that should remain and it should be duplicated and extended to Section 19. Very pragmatic section, we believe it should stay. We suggested a number of other possibilities. If the current relief is not retained, the time period of 4 years is too long. There should be de minimis rules because, as has been pointed out, these dormant companies will, of necessity, have liabilities and normally have some income every year. So we need a de minimis rule. And for intragroup debt relief, that should not be excluded from the dormant company provision because, in line with the explanatory memorandum where it was indicated that intercompany debt relief would be given and, in fact, extended. Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you very much. Next is Saifa. Thank you.
This opportunity. We've gone through the proposals. There's a few things that we didn't want to comment on everything, but there's a few things that specifically our members felt we should be addressing. The one which we know has already come up a few times, that specifically relates to foreign source remuneration. Instead of skipping over this, it's one of the main parts that our members and some companies have made quite a bit raised a lot of concerns about, so I'd like to go through some of the issues that we've dealt with, even if it is for a repetition. One of the most important things to remember is that when you've got a person working in a foreign jurisdiction, the first point or the first right obviously is that country where they work. That's where they're using the resources, and we're giving effect to that. We're now saying this, we also want to give effect to residency. Now, residency is a difficult thing to really understand. Many taxpayers don't understand it because there's this ordinary resident that often is misunderstood. So you can have a person who lives in, let's say, the UK with his family, with the family pet and the kids for 10 years, but the mere fact that he still intends at some point maybe to return to South Africa and has kept that position means that he remains an ordinary resident, which means that he still has to pay South African taxes on the same income that he already pays there, and where he has to incur those costs to substantiate his living, incurring costs in that country, which we give no recognition to. Even if we take this to a slightly shorter period of secondment, those same kind of fears are there, and some of the things we need to address with, I think the first is that the minister's proposal was that there would be an expansion on the rule to qualifying rule, to create the requirement for the exemption is that another jurisdiction is taxing it, and to the extent it's not taxing, then we'd look to the taxing, which is very different from a total repeal of the section. Because if our intention is to avoid or to eliminate double non-taxation, that's one thing. But to just remove the exemption all out is a totally different burden. Although there is double taxation credits that, or foreign tax credits that can be utilized, there is a very big difference in various countries in terms of what is determined as taxable, and even what we would give a credit to is not necessarily all taxes that they would incur or all duties that they would pay in those countries. There are certain amounts, such as earlier was mentioned, Social Security, which we would not give a recognition of a credit for here. The other thing to also remember, I say it again, this is substance, the subsistence, the cost of actually living there. It's if we go back to even in the origins of what is a good tax system, one of the critical things to understand is that it's not like a company where we're looking at the profits. Here we're looking at a person's earnings, which they have to live from, and then they still got to pay tax from. So it can have a significant effect on them when we are not recognizing the added cost. If you travel pretty much anywhere else in the world, you'll see it is substantially more expensive. So yes, your earnings might be commensurately more, but so is your expenses. And in some of these areas where you would say, well, there's very little tax, they actually use indirect taxes as a means of collecting taxes, which is far more significant. So you go to an area where we would probably say a low tax or no tax area for employment income, but the effective cost after taking indirect taxes into it means that you can't have a decent dinner for under 1,000 to 1,500 rand a night. We're not recognizing that at all. We just tax the income without recognition of what's essentially the residue. The other impact as well is that when there's an exemption, your other income isn't affected by it. When we take away the exemption and we say we give you a credit, your taxable income inflates. So whatever you left here, so let's say you've got rental properties in South Africa, that rental property has now become substantially more tax burdensome than it would have been before because of this inflated foreign earnings that you would have had, even though you get a credit, and that credit's not going to help you with your inflated South African tax position. Also, where we have a South African employer, a South African employer currently, when you take away the exemption, would have to subject their earnings to employees' tax. Now, there's no recognition in the current provision or in the recommendations in the draft for actually recognizing those credits. So the South African employer has to treat it as normal taxable remuneration to deduct employees' tax, and there is a foreign jurisdiction that taxes it for the taxpayer on assessment now to claim a refund. Now, SARS has repeatedly said that as much a risk it is that you owe SARS money, it's just as much a risk when they have to owe you money. There's fraud and a number of other risks and administrative burdens that they have to deal with in refunds. So we're asking for greater refunds and as well added administration in dealing with these. Earlier there was mention of that companies generally have problems with SARS when it comes to foreign tax credits, and that is so. Many of these audits and reviews that you go through with SARS is they often require that you have to provide actual proof of payment of those taxes, even though the relevant section refers to the foreign tax credit refers to the tax being payable and not with the right of refunding, which is very different from being paid. The other jurisdiction where I go, the paperwork I get from there, some of them are not even on electronic systems, they're manual systems, some of those. The disclosure that is there is very different periods. South Africa is unique in a February year, tax year end. And even language becomes a concern. Some of the principles of a good tax system include economic efficiency and administrative efficiency. And I'm not going to go in detail what this means, but effectively, if this was to pass and as it is recommended, we're pretty much throwing out both economic efficiency and administrative efficiency out the door and increasing the compliance cost for the taxpayer and increasing the cost and burden for SARS to administer this as well. We're also asking that since we're now relying more to treaties, that there's more and more instances of a treaty interpretation has to come into it. And if we think tax is difficult, try and unleash the general population to a treaty to try and understand that, considering that each treaty is even different. And as we mentioned, various jurisdictions have slightly different provisions, so and even different administration, different paperwork that you would get from that. So how do I substantiate to SARS what was taxed, what was the taxable income, what taxes I have liable to in a country where, for instance, there's self-assessment, or where they don't recognize things like fringe benefits. What we also need to be careful of is with provisional tax, this person has an added burden in recognizing where before, perhaps because of the exemption, they didn't need to be a provisional taxpayer, they would now fall into the trap of having to be provisional taxpayers based on the nature of their relationship that they have. So besides the collection, and I don't want to harp on those other issues that's already been dealt with too much, but I think one concern that we have, and I know that there's been questions about whether there'll be more incidents of immigration, We don't feel that necessarily there's going to be an outflow of immigration because of it. However, the person who's already established himself offshore might very well say, well, this is the purpose for us to sever ties, because it's an unnecessary burden to consider. Like the example I gave of the person who's established for years, been working in another country, they very well might take that step because it's very easy now. Our biggest concern is, in fact, that there is a likelihood that there will be greater avoidance of taxation. Because you take a person when they feel that the taxes, both from an administrative and from a quantum value, is not fair, they would look for mechanisms to avoid that and maybe to shift that somewhere. And in doing so, they're also not going to bring those funds back to South Africa. That's the real reason why we've had amnesties in the past. We link exchange control to it. So we're looking for, effectively, that funds not to return to South Africa, and that will be a pure loss to South Africa and society. In terms of the bargaining council, a lot already has been referenced to it. Our large question to this would be, not that we have a problem with giving relief to the bargaining council, but our question is, why was the VDP process not sufficient to do so? Considering that not only is every other taxpayer in a position to voluntarily correct their tax position, get relief from interest and penalties, there's also mechanisms in the current tax legislation or in the tax administration's legislation that allows for settlement agreements as well as payment schemes and that could have alleviated for where there were financial hardships in the first place. So what we effectively now have is an amnesty, the very thing we've before, after the last amnesty, said we don't want to do, because many taxpayers felt that they are being that people who have not been compliant are getting a better deal. So why bother being compliant? And as I said before, there's a precedent that potentially could be set here, because these provisions also have.
Sorry, you're at 10 minutes. You have 2 more minutes.
Okay. There's no link to the requirement that they have to ensure that future compliance is kept. So they could come clean now and tomorrow become non-compliant once again. It is also unfair because it's not available to all taxpayers, it's only to bargaining councils. And lastly, I just want to talk about, I'll skip over the loans because that's been dealt with. The one that I do want to just talk about before I finish off is the time supply rule with regards to leasehold improvements. Although there's argument to be made that that section is perhaps not necessary, there's already precedent being set in case law. However, certainty of legislation is always appreciated. The one concern that we have is that the definition of completed is not given. Now, I'd like to just give you an example of what we mean is the concern here. In Mauritius, they had a provision that related to their property taxes. And once you completed the development of a building, the property taxes would kick in. So when you would drive through Mauritius, you would find that there were many places where one wall was not plastered or completely built, because it just was never completed. They eventually had to implement legislation to force a timeline to deem it completed. Now, we have nothing like this here. We just require this leasehold, recognition of leasehold improvement for VAT, but we haven't defined that completed date. It's very easy to, in fact, defer your tax liabilities or to manipulate it in the absence of a clear definition of what is complete. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Over to colleagues and comrades. Questions, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Clearly, the foreign tax issue is a major issue, and I think everyone seems to be raising it in a way that is fairly uniform. But is there amongst everyone an acceptance to do away with double non-taxation? If one takes into account the additional cost of living, the additional levies that might be imposed in the foreign jurisdiction, so that there is not the point that someone working abroad lands off in a worse position than if that person had earned the same earnings in South Africa. Is that a kind of, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I'm asking everyone like this and not pinpointing.
The same thing that occurred to me, actually.
So if there's general acceptance of that principle, I'd like to hear that there is, or if there's not, why there should not be. Interesting, the leasehold one, I mean, that comes uniquely from SIPA and quite an interesting one. So I'm sorry you raised it here, because I stopped plastering that wall in my development and benefit from it. But thank you for raising it. It does sound like an issue. And then the issue of using a go-between on foreign companies, Mr. Chairman, I've listened, I've heard, but I can't ask questions. But for the rest, thank you very much. The bargaining councils is, again, SIPA, you're kind of unique in some respects here, because you brought up the VDP, which no one else did. But I think it's a very good point, Mr. Chairman, that there is a process already to take care of that, perhaps. But perhaps others would like to comment on the validity of that.
That general provision should cater for the bargaining council too.
That's the suggestion.
Mm. Mm. But I mean, Treasury must have had some reason, Younger. You'll be coming back on that, right?
Chris is smiling.
Sorry?
Chris is smiling. He's going to come back
tomorrow. Yeah. Okay. Right. Fine. Just to alert those of you here, you don't know, but I think you do. Treasury comes back with their responses. I think it's 2 weeks from now. Is that right, Younger? So the 12th of September or something. Yeah, and you are free to send somebody from Cape Town instead of flying in to hear what they have to say, and you'll be given a chance to reply. Right, anybody else wants to raise anything? Tivisani?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, honourable members, good morning, colleagues. Chair, I think we were just discussing the foreign exemption situation, but we'll provide a very detailed resource. But just to add on the honourable release issue, I think what we're saying with Dora is that there's got to be a point whereby there's clearly a pushback from industry about the exemption, and there's certainly in emphasis by the Treasury as well. There's got to be some ground, common ground there. But I think the common ground will certainly be the consensus that there's got to be non-double taxation arrangement. But I think the point that's very interesting, I'd like the colleagues to comment on, is the assumption that the cost of living on the other side are lower than the cost of living on the other side, on this side. Or the assumption that the taxes, I mean, I pay tax as a taxpayer, PSEI, and I also have to pay tax additionally, which is your local tax, all other taxes that you mentioned, other taxpayers will do. But I think there's broader issues that, you need to unpack. They are quite key issues whereby the tax jurisdiction tax differs from different jurisdictions, and putting a one layer policy to try to deal with it, it won't work. Maybe needs to be unpacked quite separately.
Gloria?
Good morning, colleagues. Yeah, just to add on that, we're just thinking that there are two separate issues, the taxation issue and the cost of living issue, and to try and mix the two might turn out to be tricky, because as well we're thinking when somebody makes that decision to move to a foreign country, surely you should take into consideration all those things with regards to your personal lifestyle and necessities. And I'll still need more convincing in terms of one deciding to immigrate just because of the section. I don't see it happening necessarily. Thanks. Or lastly, I think it would be interesting just what impacts there would be on our revenue collection because of this section. I think that would be more informative in terms of the necessity of the section.
Actually, I'm not compelled by the argument that people would see. Maybe you're right. Yeah, I don't know enough. Who's next? Zakele, do you want to say something? No. All right. Floyd?
Chair, most of the established tax jurisdictions, they do what the National Treasury is proposing we should do now about taxing people who work in different parts of the world. The Americans do that as well, like on all their citizens, in terms of, and it broadens their tax base in a way that is much more durable. So I don't think that there's anything fundamentally wrong with what is being proposed should be done, because if you check the extent at which income is being externalized in South Africa, it's terrible. We've raised this on many occasions that corporations are doing everything in their power to avoid their tax liabilities here in South Africa, including individuals, a huge number of them who work out their own schemes to avoid taxes. I think that in principle we should take a posture that we support a transition that says that we must tax all the citizens, wherever they are found and wherever they generate the income. I don't think that we must have a problem with that.
Yeah, it's something I've raised before, Younger. You know, Treasury will give their considered, thought through responses after they've also heard you here in 2 weeks' time. But nothing stops you intervening now, Younger. Where you inform the people here and the MPs why you do certain things, even if you'll give your full response later, so if you want to say anything. But what I want to raise with you yet again, and it's something that I would like you to respond to, we want to know give us a comprehensive explanation of how you go about these proposals. Because we feel it's like what I might call dumping. You see, these issues should be dealt with before they come to Parliament. But we're acutely aware that I'm not implying any specific individual here. I mean, those of us who've been here since 94, whenever you disagree with something, it's almost 90% of the time you'll say you're not being consulted. What you're really saying is, I haven't got my way. Right? I see Keith shaking. I'm just busy. On the other hand, the powers that be, they don't do the consultation meaningfully. It's often like nominal. And then they come to Parliament and say, yeah, but we met on the 16th of May, 17th of June. Here's these very same people, they were there. But you're not engaging with them in a give and take spirit. So we would like you to, you see, we feel it's not fair. Tax is a very complex area. I was teasingly saying to Derek Hanekom, I'm glad he's here, can you please give us the positions the NWC took on Monday on these issues? Because the MPs get their direction from the party. Right? I'm sure they discussed everything, including the crisis in Mongolia, but they didn't give us Derek here to come and explain to us. So I don't think it's right, clearly, for Treasury. Well, you know, let me be clear, there's nothing to apologize for. We are not tax experts here. Well, some of us are. And so, unfortunately, they're all in the opposition parties here. Even Floyd, who came here 2 days ago, seems to know more about tax than the average ANC MP does, but then he's done some studies and this is an area interesting. But the fact of the matter is that take me, 61 years though I may be, 45 years in the struggle, 23 years in Parliament, how am I going to match you? Oh, you with all your degrees and your thousands of years of experience, I'm not going to apologize for that. But then we have Sakile Shlope and Antonio Manemela, and so on. They too, bright and sharp as they are, hardworking as they are, they can't match you at this stage. But that's the future. The next time it'll be a new demographic representation. But 10 years from now, they will be able to match you and also outshine you. So at this stage, Tracy, you mustn't do this, really. It's not fair. You know, I tried reading the stuff last night, and I'm telling you, it's very hard. It is very hard. I've chaired 5 committees. Never once have I been so befuddled by some of the claims made. I tried to look at the stuff. Do you really think I'm capable of understanding this? I can't speak for Floyd here, and I can speak for Derek and me. Do you think we're capable of understanding all this here, every clause? No. So you know what? I think Parliament must now get heavy on Treasury. That you do your consultation before. What we find also is often you do make concessions. They might not accept it, but we see it. Before you even come here, on the 12th, you were saying, yeah, okay, on reflection. Well, it's not on reflection. You could have done that at the outset. So I think the first item on the agenda is consultation. We will also allow you to speak. So I think the first, who's you taking notes to vote, the first 15, 20 minutes, tell us how exactly you bring these bills to us Bearing in mind, I know how it is, that it's a draft, it's connected to the MTBPS, the earlier rates and monetary bills, and I understand all of that. But still, you know, you should come with a bill where you've consulted properly and then said, on the 10 things that were raised, these 3 we agree to, these 2 we're thinking about, these 5 we're saying no. But we have consulted them, it's no. Clear, you're decisive. So, can you tell us, when you're here on the 12th, how you do it, right? And you can say a bit now. So, the other thing I need to tell you is that our committee, Trade and Industry, Minerals and ourselves, we're meeting yet again with police tomorrow to look at illicit financial flows. We want to see people in jail. Really. Big people. The clients that you represent, that some of you help to avoid paying taxes. So you shouldn't come here and pretend, you know, you support the free market system. And you present it, some of you, as a clean system, it's honest, it's about individual merit, it's about fair play. Oh, please. Many of you are helping. As Floyd rightly said one day, we should hold all of you here and ask you. Even if it's legal, do you think it's right? Tax avoidance. Tax evasion is illegal. Tax. Hey, you know what? I'll tell you what I think. I can't say this is the committee's view. It makes no difference whether it's tax avoidance or tax evasion. You just have to pay up. So your companies are globally complicit for getting big business in particular not to pay taxes. So your credibility, not you as individuals, my brothers and sisters here, but your companies, this is what you do. So on tax avoidance, I'm telling you now, you'll have no sympathy. Very little. In fact, the way it is, I must find the words. You know, like you sometimes say, a person is guilty until proven otherwise. Well, frankly, on tax avoidance, think of a similar peril. That's a philosophical approach the majority in this committee had. So on tax avoidance, you will have to come and present overwhelming arguments. So on tax avoidance, you will get nothing from the ANC, I can tell you now, unless you can come with more formidable. I haven't finished all of this. I'm actually, I must confess, I'll do it over the weekend, but and before the 12th. But let me put this to you. On tax avoidance, we're signaling to all of you, we're going to be very sympathetic to Treasury, unless they're extremely unreasonable, unless we get independent advice that they sow. So on that one, I don't want to say more. Younger, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the consultation process, when you respond on the 12th, you're going to say how the consultation process is, but briefly, we published a bill for public comments on the 19th of July, and we received more than 100 comments. And today is the public hearings, and then we're going to have workshops on the 4th and the 5th of September. From those workshops, when you bring the response document to the Parliament, is when that we're going to say accepted. We agree with their comments, and then we do accept, we're going to revise the bill, we're not going to revise the bill. That's how the process is. So on the 12th of September, some of the comments are valid, we agree with them. Some of them will say accepted, some not accepted. That's how we're going to do when we bring the response document on the 12th of September. That's the consultation process. And in terms of Section 10102, the repeal of foreign employment exemption, we've even said in the proposed bill that the effective date is postponed for 2 years to 2019 so that we can sort out the administrative difficulties that they are talking about. So that has been given effect in the draft bill that the effective date is postponed for 2 years to 2019. That is another thing. And then regarding the bargaining council, the issue that why can't you use the foreign voluntary disclosure? The issue with the bargaining council is payment to members of the bargaining council, of which employees tax would have been withheld. Those members, some of them have died. Some of them are no longer working. And then when we looked at the issue of the voluntary disclosure, if they can't find those members, maybe those members have died, some of them have been retrenched, how are we going to apply the voluntary disclosure in that scenario? We looked at all the issues, hence we came up with this proposal. But we're going to respond properly formally on the 12th of September. But those are the highlights.
You know, some of the representations here almost projected it as people are bewildered while you make certain decisions. It's as if it's like outlandish almost, right? Do you want to respond to that? you know, like they seem puzzled. Why are you doing this? We don't understand. Explicitly, one hinted at it.
That is in terms of Section 10.1 of the PSU, I think. And as we have said, that residents are taxed on their worldwide income. When we introduced the worldwide income taxation in 2001, we gave this exemption, but we said we're going to look at this exemption in the explanatory memo so that it is not abused. And when it is abused, we're going to review. So it has come to the situation whereby we think that we see that the exemption is abused, we are reviewing it. And so by giving the effective date of postponing for 2 years, we're going to look at this issue, that is the SARS system of foreign tax credits that they are talking about, and also the revenue impact, and also those issues that they are talking about regarding the cost of living. And then we're going to do the review. It's not like, it's not going to be in effect now or next year. The 2 years will give us that time for the review of this exemption.
I don't know, maybe it's an unfair question. You do, a significant number of countries do what Treasury is proposing to do in this regard.
Yes, a significant number of countries do, but we found that in the US, for instance, there is an exemption in terms of amount that you earn, like an exemption threshold in terms of the foreign income you earn. So those are the things that we're going to look at. Do we introduce an exemption threshold? What do we introduce in order to limit the impact?
The other thing to say is, I think we understand also, with 0.5% growth rates likely this year, with the economy being what it is, a lot of people are under pressure, Treasury, also. And they want to avoid paying taxes. They will argue then they can reinvest in the economy, never mind the trillions of rands lying there not being invested. But that's partly also the politicians must sort out that by running this country better, right? And more and secure more confidence. But what I'm saying is, you know, we understand those pressures on you and your clients and so on. But on the other hand, the very same pressures mean that revenue is not coming in, and the state, the government, the majority party is also under pressure to secure revenue. So we need to find all the right balances. Having said that, can we hand over to all of you? We've got to go on to the next session at what time is it? 11, and we're at 43. But I mean, I used up 4 minutes at the beginning, so why don't we say we've got about 15, 20 minutes, okay? So there's four of you, each of you can have 3 minutes or so. Thank you. Okay, let's start with the first person. You know the order in which you spoke.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the members for your questions. Most of the questions revolve around the 10.1.0 repeal, and so I'm just going to deal with that first. The question around international presence, I think Younger has answered that, at least partly anyway. It's not unique in terms of what South Africa is proposing. Absolutely not. I think what it doesn't take into account, though, is, I'm not going to say unique circumstances of South Africa, but unusual circumstances of South Africa as well. So we do need to factor that into the equation in looking at it, and not rely blindly, if you like, on international precedent. It needs to be adapted to suit South Africa's circumstances. The question around would we accept doing away with double non-taxation under Section 10.1.0? Absolutely. I don't think we're opposed to that as a matter of principle, that there shouldn't be double non-taxation. I think it's an absolutely valid point. The issue, though, revolves around how do we do so without suffering the unintended consequences, and I'll come to some of those in a moment responding to some of the other questions. Insofar as the cost of living assumption is concerned, it's a fact that most of the countries that we're dealing with here are far more expensive to live in than South Africa. We're dealing with countries, if you talk about the non-taxed countries at all, the likes of the United Arab Emirates, and anyone who's been to the United Arab Emirates will tell you that it's extraordinarily expensive to live there. Even with the likes of a tax country like the UK, we all know how expensive it is. Anyone who's been to London knows it's expensive to visit it, let alone to live in it. And those are factors that need to be taken into account as well. Often when it comes to expats, it's also not just the case of the costs, the living costs that they have in the other country. Often those expats end up maintaining two households, if you like, one in the foreign country in which they're working, and another household in South Africa which they're maintaining as well. So that you can often end up with duplication of living costs. And it's also about taking that into consideration. There is already a recognition in our tax law, if you like, around the additional or the higher cost of living in other countries. And that is taken into account in subsistence allowances. So we have a subsistence allowance for South Africa that's regulated, but we also have very different subsistence allowances on a specified country list, varying by country, for foreign travel. So there's recognition already in our law around the different costs of living in different countries, insofar as that aspect is concerned as well. The question around what would be the impact on revenue collection, well, this is a very loaded question, because no one really actually knows the answer, and I'd venture to say that Treasury doesn't know the answer to that either. There are a number of reasons for this, but the primary reasons are, number one, we actually don't really know how many expats, South African expats, there are. Rumour has it, if you like, that in the UAE alone, there are some 50,000 South African expats living and working in the UAE. But no one knows for certain. Even if we knew the number of South African expats that there were in these different countries, and I alluded to it earlier in my presentation, many of those expats may inadvertently already have...
You're at 4 minutes. Can you send them in writing? Just round up, please.
Sure.
Send it in writing, because actually it's better when we read it as well.
Okay.
So you'll take... But just round up in the next 30 seconds, yeah?
All right. So many of those expats may already have inadvertently ceased to be South African tax residents, in which case South Africa would have no rights to tax them whatsoever, including on their investment income outside of South Africa, etc. Okay, so that's another consideration needs to be taken into account. I'm not going to talk about the VDP. I think you've touched on that as far as bargaining council is already concerned.
Try to keep it quick. Let me just say something, though, touching on what you said earlier. I think one of the problems that we're having in the discussion is our perception of reality. One of the difficulties that we have is the lack of information. So a lot of the principles like double non-taxation, a lot of the stuff is coming from the OECD and coming from the Northern Hemisphere. But we have a different reality. And one of the issues when you're coming to the expat space is a different reality for our people. They're operating in Africa. In Africa, the documentation isn't very good. The taxes can be quite high. People who are going into Nigeria are not going to avoid tax, trust me. It is very difficult to do that. And so you can have theories based on what you get out of Paris, or you can get theories that are based on what's happening in reality here. And the difficulty, to be fair to Treasury and SARS, is they also have a different reality. So some of the event avoidance they've seen, they picked up an avoidance, they picked up another avoidance, they picked up another avoidance, and they think that's the reality. But a lot of people on the other side have different realities. Now, even when you look at tax advisors, when I hear even this parliamentary committee, the bulk of tax advisors are compliance officers. Okay, that's the bulk of our members. They fill out returns, they want to comply, they don't want to take risks. If a taxpayer wants to take risks, they do it on their own. Their problem is the taxpayers may lie to them, which is a bit of an evasion, but they don't want to be engaging in that. Now, so the problem here is that we don't know each other's realities, and because of that, there's a lot of misunderstanding. Now, the main problem with 1010, in theory, you should be able to rely on the credit. The problem is the South African credit is it talks about proved to be payable. That's the first problem. You only get the credit if it's proved to be payable. Now, one of the issues that's happening on the ground administratively is the standard of proof on the taxpayer has grown. One of the big battles on administration, we're not talking about it today, the bulk of our members are complaining about the burden of proof on the taxpayer, on the type of documentation. It comes up very clearly here. The other one is the proof to be payable. Even if you paid it, the Treasury people, not the Treasury people, SARS people may argue, well, you didn't have to pay it. You paid it. Now, the reason why you pay it in Africa is because if you don't, it's just a problem. Sometimes they demand taxes that are really not due and payable, Tanzania being the chief culprit in that regard. There's another problem with the credit, that technically you only get the credit year end. So you should pay double tax all year long as an employee and only get the credit at the end, which means you have to go get a refund. Good luck to you. So there's a bit of reality issues going on here, and the problem is all of these realities are a problem. Now, to be fair to government, when you look at the share buyback scheme, now you can say that, well, I would like to be able to say that all tax advisors are innocent, we want to pay maximum tax, and you won't believe me. Now, if you look at the share buyback scheme, there was billions being lost in that scheme. I think PwC has mentioned a year ago. I think we mentioned a year before that. The bottom line is that there are gaps, and sometimes there's big money in those gaps, and when SARS and Treasury see those, they go, look at you, you're all crooks. Now, the bottom line is there are people who play a rough game, and there are a number of people who do that, and there are a lot of people who are also playing an innocent game. And the bottom line is we're getting mixed up between the two. Not all Revenue Service officials are out for blood, some are. But we remember the bad first, and so it's contaminating all of our debates, and we're assuming everybody's out for blood. Now the guys who are most worried about the foreign income exemption is the employers. Because the employers are facing high taxes in Africa, and they're afraid that this is going to be a double tax, and they're going to have to bear it. That's really the issue for most of the employers. Now, there are issues like Dubai. I think that's the minority issue. Mauritius is a minority issue. You can debate that either way. I think that's what Treasury was really going after, to be quite frank. So I'm just saying the main thing is as long as we have different realities, you're going to come and hear different noises, and how the heck do you rationalize them? So I think that's the main point. I think the issue of the bargaining council is a subtle one, and I'll close it at that, is that there's a feeling that certain political groups get more preference than others, okay? And that's it. I've probably said far too much on that issue, and that's that. But again, some of the avoidances have to be closed down. We believe in that. The share buybacks, there are a few other ones. Just don't kill the good with the bad.
Minutes.
Chair. Most of it's been said, but I think the question dealing with 1010, do we support the fact that we're dealing with double non-taxation or effectively addressing it? The answer is yes. I think coming from the debate is how do we do so without creating further problems? And I think you correctly raised the problem, and it's back to the first point we raised, is that when we come here and we have the answer, and the answer is either yes, we agree in principle, or no, we don't agree with you, at least then we are in a position to consult with the, or make a presentation that we are either a meeting of minds or we are totally different worlds, and we have looked at certain complications or we have not. And the problem is when we get to the standing committee and actually address these matters and we've not had those initial meetings of mind, it makes it very difficult to then in 10 minutes redact and limit our discussion to what we believe to be the most pertinent parts of where we are not meeting minds or being in disagreement. And I think That makes it very difficult. So are we in agreement with addressing double? Yes. And we're getting down to the detail as to how we do so. And once again, the process that we're concerned with doesn't facilitate us in actually getting to a good answer in either helping Treasury or the Standing Committee in understanding what those concerns are. So where are we getting it wrong that we actually go too far, or we are injuring parties that we shouldn't? And I think that's the same with the Bargaining Council debate to a large extent. Back to the, just on the 1010, and I think the complexity of the matter is also that we separate two issues. I mean, there are two quite distinct groups. One we have, as Keith noted, the South African employer sending people abroad, but then there are also quite a lot of people who are just employed in foreign countries by foreign employers, which to a large extent I would think are the more people focused on the double non-taxation. Why? Because it's quite easy to cover the South African employers to a large extent because they have a South African presence. Tax presence. So those complexities, once again, are all to be addressed on once we've had those discussions so that we can better and properly inform the committee.
order minutes next time you appear before this committee. Who's next? Saeed.
From our side as well, you know, obviously the issue of double non-taxation, we wouldn't want to support anything that helps an individual to avoid their fair share of taxes. That's a cost that you have of being a citizen. But the problem that there's a lack of certainty of what the outcome would be. There's administrative burden. There's it's just the complexity that comes with it, and the interim consequences and net effect of tax is just, it's not palatable in the current circumstance. And while we appreciate that we have almost 2 years for the implementation date of it, and it's very we're pretty gracious for that extra time, the reality is that some of these other changes that might be necessary will even need further legislative changes. So for instance, where an employer does not need to deduct full employees tax off current remuneration, because at the moment the employer cannot recognize foreign tax credits against that remuneration. So that means is you can have the conversation what you want, but it needs a legislative amendment to give effect to it. The likewise for instance, how SARS or the burden of proof that SARS might want to that, those SARS won't deal with that in terms of an administrative element until the legislation is physically there and actually implemented. And the systems, the mechanisms will only be put into place then. So we can have all the time we want, but at the day of when it kicks in, we're still going to sit with that problem if it's not. And that's where consultation up front is one of how do we address it, and we kind of workshop it rather than this legislation and we have to now give opposing position to it. That collaborative part is not really there.
Because of this international conference, the tea and coffee's only come half an hour ago. So if you want to go out and get it, but we're going to continue the meeting. It's just individually you can go out. Sorry, what do you want to say?
My name's Carl Gericke, Group Tax Executive, Jen. I just want to make a point that's not been made yet in relation to the 10182 exemption repeal. When Mr. Manuel introduced this in Parliament way back in 2001, the main driving purpose behind this thing was skills transfer into Africa and back to South Africa. That hasn't been discussed. That also speaks to your point about illicit financial flows, right? If I now have to pick up an additional tax burden for my SA employee, I have to tax equalize him. In other words, I have to pay his tax, right? Otherwise, I'm not going to incentivize him to go where he has to go, right? And that's going to increase my cost, okay? So please, let's not forget about the skills transfer angle.
Apply to that. Or you want to come back later, whatever you choose, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. It's Chris. Thanks, Jay. I mean, yeah, on the skills angle, I mean, we spoke about, this is a very emotive issue, and I mean, we just wanted to say, we did say to the committee when we presented, I think it was 2 weeks ago, that we are open to all these points and potential future amendments. And there is a lot of confusion. I mean, the big one is it's not about citizenship, it's about tax residency. So there's a huge amount of people saying we're going to give our South African passports, etc. And it's not about that. It's about tax residency. So we just want to clear that. On the skills point, you know, our DDG said last time that, you know, actually this is creating an incentive for people to leave, because now if they go offshore, then they'll have a much higher net income initially. And then do those people actually come back? So as you said, skills transferred to Africa and back. But are those people coming back? I mean, anecdotally, I know a lot of people who haven't. Anyway.
We will continue the exchange in 2 weeks' time. Now it's Bafa, where are you? Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Leon Gitsia. I'm the chairman of the Banking Association's Tax Committee, and I've got my colleague Albert Nimenez from Standard Bank here. Chair, I just want to check, would you prefer to have the slides up, or can we... Yeah, I'm just not quite sure if it was loaded on the computer in the front.
Alan's been exempted from work. He's not well, so the doctor put him off for a week. So he's left now. So can we manage without him, please? Because we will go through all of it. Don't worry. By the time they come here, we'll have read everything. 2 weeks here.
That's fine. Thank you, Chair. Just in terms of agenda, we've made submissions on all the amendments, but we're going to focus purely on the issues affecting banks. because there are a few specific sections introduced in this draft taxation laws amendment bill that's specific to banks. The big one is dealing with impairments, which is just a big word for our provisions for bad and doubtful debts. So we're going to go through the proposed changes there. And just on that point, I just want to also just highlight that one of the members, Capitec Bank, they will make a separate submission as they've got some differences of application due to their banking model, and they'll present separately on that. And then lastly, we're going to just deal with what we call the alternative method of computing interest received and paid in the banking system. I'm going to hand over to Albert, who's going to take us through the impairment side.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair and members. I just want to, before we actually get into Section 11JA and the proposals, I just want to actually highlight a couple of issues on the current dispensation in terms of Section 11J that has been around for many, many years. The Commissioner for SARS has got a discretion at the moment in order to that is exercised in practice by way of two different methods, and that's how the doubtful debt allowance is determined for a normal taxpayer out there. In other words, no special dispensation necessary that we're actually going to zoom in now. And it's determined in terms of 25% of the list, or alternatively, a formula basis allowance. The formula basis allowance takes into account various variables. Some of them are like the actual bad debt write-offs, net of recoveries over a five-year period, kind of a rolling average, in looking at that in conjunction with the credit sales of a company or the credit that's been extended into the market. Then we have the special banking dispensation at the moment. It's been in place since 1998. Generally provides for 100% allowance on the specific component of the impairment, that in terms of the IAS 39 methodology, that is the specific impairments. It provides for an 80% allowance on the portfolio-specific impairment component and a 25% allowance on the IBNR component. And those are the components of the portfolio impairment. And we understand from discussions with SARS that the average blended rate allowance that is currently allowed in terms of the current dispensation to banks is in the region of 75%. So BASA actually, with the introduction of the time that led up to IFRS 9, actually started the process of having these discussions with SARS and National Treasury in order to actually get the current special dispensation formalised going forward once IFRS 9 has been introduced, and we've held various workshops. And we've come quite a long way, and now we actually have the draft legislation in front of us, and we want to actually just make a couple of comments on that. First of all, the default position for the draft is at 25% allowance, and the intention there is to actually allow the 25% allowance on stages 1 and 2. So stage 2, roughly, that's the old regime that used to be the portfolio specific impairment component. There's a little bit of an overlap between that stage 1 and 2, but that it used to be 80%, and now it's going to be down to 25%. In principle, the BASA members are actually happy to accept these lower allowances, or 25% allowance in principle on the default position. On the specific impairment component, or the stage 3 of IFRS 9, the proposal is to actually allow an 85% allowance. The BASA is proposing that allowance should rather be 100%, and the reason for that is that post-impairment write-offs are actually already, or recoveries of those post-impairments are already taken into account in the formulas, the models that the banks are actually going to apply in order to determine the stage 3 impairment. It's our understanding that the The 85% that's on the table at the moment is to cater for post-impairment recoveries. As we say, due to the fact that the impairment calculation already takes that into account, it's our view that you will be double counting if the allowance is not set at 100%. And as I said, VASA accepts the reduced 25% allowance on stages 1 and 2 of IFRS 9. The other important point that we just want to make is that currently the proposal is the hook that this higher allowance should actually hang on is referring to Regulation 67 of the Banks Act. And it's referring to a definition of amounts in default. It's our view that that reference should rather be made to IFRS 9. There is a definition already in Appendix A to IFRS 9 that deals with credit impaired amounts. It's our belief that the level of credit impaired amounts versus the amounts in default as per the banking regulation is going to be plus minus at the same level. So we just feel that it should rather be IFRS 9. And the reason for that is the models that the banks are actually busy introducing at the moment are all geared to focus on the accounting standard on IFRS 9. There's lots of money that's been invested in that process at the moment in order to get those models up and running. There's a huge amount of external and internal audit costs that the banks incur in order to audit those models. So we believe that that's going to be the best way to refer to is rather to the IFRS 9 than to Banking Regulation 67. Then, lastly, the last point that we actually want to make on the doubtful debt allowance is we feel that there should be a phase-in of the cash tax effect that the banks will have to actually suffer over a period of time. We're proposing at least a time period of 3 years to actually phase in that initial cash tax effect, as it's going to be quite hard on banks to actually fork out the additional tax in only 1 year. And this is not something new. It's similar to Section 24JB, the phase-in period of 3 years that's been introduced in that part of the legislation as well. I think those are the main concerns. I think I just want to come back to one issue, and it's really that currently it's our understanding that 11JA, the special dispensation that's available for the banks, is the specific legislation, so a bank would not be able to actually rely on 11J, the current dispensation for everybody out there, but will have to actually apply the special dispensation. It is very likely that once the numbers are run, that a particular bank might actually come to the conclusion that the allowance in terms of the specific dispensation is actually going to be less than what the bank would have got by applying the formula-based calculation that is out there. So I just want to throw that in as well and say that it's not to say that the specific banking dispensation is actually going to give a more favourable answer than the current dispensation that's out there at the moment.
Thank you very much. If the members want to look at Bank Regulation 67, it's on page 5 of the text. Then there's Capitec, right? Next. Is that right? Believe.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just in addition to VASA, Capitec just wanted to make a clear distinction between your more traditional banks as well as your unsecured lenders. Now, just to give a bit of background, when we grant credit, we do it on a risk-based approach, and what that is we price for the client going into default, and we represent that by a probability of that client actually being written off. So what that means is our default actually happens on the first period that the person goes into arrears. where a lot of more of the traditional banks are actually raising the default only after 90 days. Now, the clear distinction there and the fundamental difference is more of the traditional banks that their highest loans are actually secured. So there's an asset that's behind that loan. So their probabilities of default and when they start raising default is only at a much later stage in the period. Sometimes actually all the way until after 12 months before they actually write off some of those loans. Now, based on our probabilities, we write the loan off at 90 days. So the clear difference is with the Banks Act and the 90-day definition of default is we've actually already written the loan off at 90 days and we don't have a provision after 90 days based on our probabilities. And that's a clear distinction between the unsecured lenders and the traditional banks. And when we get to IFRS 9 and the difference between the traditional banks and the unsecured lenders, we won't have a Stage 3 provision under IFRS 9. So there'll be quite a difference in tax treatment if we had to make the proposals and reference the tax changes to IFRS 9 Stage 3 for that higher specific allowance. Currently under the Basel Directive, our specific impairment based on the formulas that Albert's been discussing from Basel is saying that we're actually completely aligned with what percentage of allowance we're getting for our specific impairments under the Basel Directive. The proposed current changes to the Tax Act will actually only give us a complete 25% allowance and not the additional allowance that the other banks will be able to benefit from. What this achieves is a very significant deferred tax that we'll have to pay on our balance sheet, which gives a huge drag to our capital adequacy ratios in terms of our banking regulations. So what I want to put on the table and what we've proposed is that if the proposed tax changes refer to the Banks Act, we need to make a distinction between the traditional banks and the unsecured lenders in order to make sure that all banks actually get a fair tax treatment. And that also if that is changed to actually rather reference IFRS 9, that on that we also make sure that there's a distinction between the traditional banks and the unsecured lenders, that if it's Stage 3 for the higher provision, the 100% allowance, for the unsecured lenders, it's a Stage 2 and 3 for IFRS 9. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we can then come back to the issues in the first session if people want to. Law Society.
Good morning, Honourable Chair. Robert Gadd representing the Law Society's Tax Committee. We've made written submissions and there's no need to traverse them. I know that they'll be discussed in detail at the workshops to which we've been invited. Thank you. I'd like to just briefly touch on three topics, namely interest-free loans to companies, the extension to the controlled foreign company rules, and thirdly, share buybacks and dividends, the new anti-avoidance measures. To begin with, the Section 7C amendments, which deal with the interest-free loans to companies. The new Section 7C was debated before this committee last year, and the provision is designed to target the avoidance of estate duty by way of injecting assets into trusts funded by interest-free loan accounts. This year's proposal is to expand the anti-avoidance rule by including loans to companies which are connected to such trusts. So in the tax context, the word connected goes way beyond mere ownership, and it is possible that a company could be connected to a trust merely through the common denominator of one of the beneficiaries of the trust. In other words, the shares of the company are not necessarily owned by the trust to which it is connected. So there is no mischief in the situation where a person lends money interest-free to a company. It's a conventional method of capitalizing companies in South Africa and abroad. It's akin to equity. No mischief arises because it simply makes the shares of the company more valuable. There's only a mischief
when money is lent interest-free to a company which is owned by a trust because then the growth is sheltered within the trust. We therefore respectfully submit that the ambit of this proposal should be limited purely to the mischief, namely shares of companies owned by trusts, which creates the same effect as if the loan was made to the trust itself. Then there's a second aspect of this same set of rules, interest-free loans, and it concerns share incentive schemes. We welcome the acknowledgement that interest-free loans to share incentive schemes should not be caught by the anti-avoidance rule. It's in the public interest that share incentive schemes, in fact, should not be adversely affected. However, the dispensation for share incentive schemes has been limited. It excludes situations basically where you have family-owned companies or a large family stake in a company. And that extends to many, many companies in South Africa who would have a legitimate interest in increasing the spread of their ownership by introducing a share incentive scheme. So respectfully submit that the opportunity for abuse using a share incentive scheme to divert shares to another family member is extremely remote. And possibly this rule could be parked and the use of share incentive schemes could be monitored. And if indeed there is some abuse, then this could be tightened up in future. But quite honestly, I can't see a situation where a share incentive scheme could be abused in conjunction with the interest-free loans in such a way that doesn't really get very highly taxed under Section 8 capital C, which would turn all the benefits into taxable income. If I may then mention some comments on the expansion of the rules relating to controlled foreign companies. I'm sure this has been addressed in enormous detail in the various submissions. One of the issues is that the test for whether a company should be caught by the new rules has to do with accounting control, and it has to do with the interposition of the trust. The way we understood the explanatory memorandum, it would require both of these hurdles to be met in order for the rule to be applied, but the way it's currently drafted, there are two different distinct situations because the use of the word or in introducing the test. So it's actually a simple drafting point, which I'm sure will be discussed in the workshops. An aspect of the extension of the rules to controlled foreign companies has been the proposed introduction of Section 25BC. And this provision would require distributions from foreign trusts, which in turn hold foreign companies, to be fully taxed in the hands of the South African beneficiaries of the trust. Now, this rule disregards the nature and quality of the underlying source of income. So it would be consistent with our current rules relating to distributions by a trust if the underlying nature and quality of the amounts in question was identified and sort of traced through. So in other words, if we have a trust holding shares in a company and the company makes a capital gain, which then is distributed to the trust and in turn to the beneficiaries, one would think that they should be taxed as if they had made the capital gain, in other words, as a capital gain. The current proposal would turn that capital gain into income. It seems unfair. It's not aligned with the position for local trusts. I might just mention in addition that the wording of the proposed rule, it's not entirely clear that it's distinguishing correctly between the word vested and the word distributed. The two words are used in the context of this provision, and vesting and distribution have different meanings and different tax points, and we submit it's very important that that's clarified when we get to the final legislation. Onto the third and final aspect. These are the new amendments to Section 22 of the Act and Paragraph 43 capital A of the Act Schedule, which deal with share buybacks and dividends. The Honourable Minister identified that the technical application of the dividend rules combined with the capital gains tax rules had the effect that corporate shareholders of a company are able to exit from that company without triggering any immediate tax. Of course, it does mean that the gains, they still sit in a company and it ultimately would attract dividend tax when they're distributed, but there's no immediate tax effect to the transaction. And the Minister, Honourable Minister, has warned taxpayers that he's not happy with this. The proposed amendments, however, in our view, go beyond what is necessary to target this particular type of tax avoidance. The mischief is transactions in terms of which shares are bought back by the company in lieu of the shares being sold to the incoming shareholder or the incoming acquirer. But the proposed amendment will actually claw in dividends which are distributed by the company unconnected with the sale of the shares. Innocent dividends which are distributed by a company which subsequently becomes the target of a takeover transaction will then be taxed in the hands of the seller. This cannot be correct. They are unconnected with the takeover of the company. And we therefore respectfully submit that the amendment should be very, very narrowly confined to dividends which arise in the context of the takeover itself and which arise from the takeover event, and which do not constitute ordinary going concern dividends distributed by the company as an independent commercial event. Secondly, and finally, the effective date of the proposed amendment is a source of concern. According to the draft, it will take effect on 19 July 2017, but this is problematic in practice and for real-life takeovers and mergers. The proposal does not refer to the entering into of an agreement after the 19th of July. Instead, it's tied to a technical idea, which is the disposal event. But in the context of a takeover transaction, the disposal may be just one isolated step, which might have been preceded by a number of other commercial steps, the signature of the agreement, cash flows, and other events taking place, with the disposal potentially occurring quite far down the track. Now, the problem is that although, in a sense, we've had notice, or taxpayers have had notice of the proposed change, those who have already signed up agreements and maybe even commenced implementing those agreements are not able to avail themselves of this notice and retrace their steps. They are locked into the agreements. And we therefore respectfully submit that as a matter of fair process and policy, the rules should apply, and this is a general proposition, these rules should apply to transactions which are signed up after the law changes has been made known. That concludes my comments. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Okay. Who's next? We're at Weber Wynn. Go ahead, please.
Chairman, honourable members, thanks for giving us the opportunity to present today. My name is Graham Fionn. I'm a director of tax from Weber Wenzel. I have my colleague Jun Chong, who will also be presenting with me. A lot of the points have already been touched on in some of the discussions, so I'm not going to revisit those, but the ones I wanted to emphasise were in respect of the waiver of or reduction of debt in the case of a dormant company. We understand the provision. It's a good provision. It helps wind up companies where effectively there is debt. You want to wind up the company, but you prevent doing so because of the potential tax consequences of it. Unfortunately, the legislation as drafted has a huge anti-avoidance flavour to it, and it specifically talks to something like the company cannot have earned any income in the current year or preceding 3 years. Any dormant company generally has a bank account that's earning interest on a daily basis on that bank account. So that already takes most companies or dormant companies out of this provision. So although the provision is well intended and understood and welcomed, I think the requirements are too stringent to qualify and perhaps need to be revisited in order for companies to make use of the provision. The next provision I was just going to talk to was the effectively what we talk about intergroup debt conversions, where we convert debt to shares. And again, the proposals and provisions put forward are understood. The one concern we do have, though, is that where it gives relief from income tax and is expanded in the context of group companies to give relief from income tax on certain conversions of debt to equity, what it then does is it takes away the provision that gave relief under the capital gains tax schedule. So although it's aiding the process or is a good provision, unfortunately it's adding on the income tax but taking away from the capital gains tax provisions, and therefore that presents a problem. The next provision I just wanted to touch on was one that has been addressed already, but really the what we call dividend stripping arrangements or subscription and buyback transactions.
And this is where I think a case that the legislation has been drafted in such a manner that it's adopted a sledgehammer approach as opposed to maybe using a surgical instrument to address the issue. And the issue is one of the loophole that is utilized to effectively exit certain investments without paying capital gains tax. And really that's what the legislation should be aimed at. Unfortunately, it's so broadly drafted, it affects many legitimate transactions. For example, the mere redemption of a preference share would be caught by this, where a shareholder also owns ordinary shares in the company. And clearly that is not the intention. And secondly, for example, where a company distributes shares that it owns in another company to its shareholder, and then the shareholder sells those shares, there would be capital gains tax on the distribution of those shares. And again, when the company sells the shares, there'd be another instance of capital gains tax. So effectively, a double tax in a sense. So that's problematic. So really, the intention and the purpose of the legislation is accepted, understood, and we are in agreement with it. However, just extremely broad and catches a lot more than it was ever intended to catch. The last provision I wanted to address was what we call, effectively, that deals with what we call contributed tax capital, and really where this is utilized is a when dividends are distributed, that's subject to dividends withholding tax, but if you distribute contributed tax capital, that's not subject to dividends withholding tax. And where this is potentially exploited is where foreign companies will dispose of a South African company to another South African company in which they hold shares. And by doing so, they don't pay tax, but at the same time, they step up what we call the contributed tax capital, which allows them to return cash offshore without paying dividends withholding tax. And clearly, that's a loophole. The legislation addresses that, but again, unfortunately, I think it catches transactions where creating this additional contributed tax capital was not the intention, but rather simply to acquire a company in South Africa. So you have a foreign company wishes to acquire a company in South Africa. It does so. These rules will catch it where it, for example, creates a South African company, introduces cash into that South African company, and then goes and buys the target company. What we're saying here is that this provision should be narrowed to address what we call intergroup or group of companies transactions, and not capture what we call legitimate third-party transactions. So in other words, the intention again of the legislation is understood and accepted, but again too broad in the sense that it catches also pure acquisitions of South African companies by foreign companies from third parties, and not only in a group context. That's it from my side too.
Hello everyone, I will be talking about the CFC amendments. Notably, paragraph BI, woman I, of the CFC definition, and also section 25BC. Firstly, we would like to support the comments already made by PwC, SAICA, and Law Society South Africa on the uncertainty of the CFC amendments. Now, page 59 of the EM refers to Action 3 of the BEPS final report on how to define CFCs. That is, one of the definitions is, one of the definitions in Action 3 is in paragraph 26. Paragraph 26 is actually the only paragraph that refers to trust. And I would like to read the extract, and that's, although CFC rules would appear based only to apply to corporate entities, many countries include trusts in limited circumstances to ensure that companies in the parent jurisdiction cannot circumvent CFC rules just by changing the legal form of their subsidiaries. Now, South Africa and the National Treasury and Parliament as well has a constitutional mandate in the Constitution to refer and take into account international instruments. And one of these international instruments would be the Action 3 final report published by the OECD. Now, as mentioned earlier, there is only one mention in the whole report to trust in paragraph 26. And there are 2 points I wish to raise. The first is that the inclusion is in limited circumstances. The second is that when there is inclusion to trust, it's so that companies in the parent jurisdiction cannot circumvent CFC rules, not individuals. We strongly urge and we strongly request that a lot more research be done.